Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Last week, the Triad Arts team bade farewell to our wonderful summer intern, Michaela Nance. She's back at Catawba College now, studying recording engineering, music, and more. But before her trip back to campus, she left us with this.
I'm Michaela Nance with Life Size, live in Studio A. Here's a song from their upcoming album called Walk Right Through Me. I'm Michaela Nance with Life Size, live in Studio A. Life Size has a distinctive sound and a style all its own. The band draws from blues, folk, gospel, and funk. Critics rave about their flawless three-part harmonies and impressive instrumental technique. Bassist Greg Moore and drummer Tevin Carr couldn't make it, but the songwriting trio, Elijah Motika, Jake Martin, and Silas Boyle, did come by for a special performance live in Studio A. We talked about their new songwriting style, their upcoming album, Live at Lee Street, and more.
Your words flow like poetry. I just sat to side it. I just smiled, felt you walk right through me.
You all have such distinct songwriting styles and style of music, the melodies that you write. Can you tell me how that all comes together to form your band?
Luck.
Well, it's all pretty spontaneous, you know. It's a challenge because we said, like, I come from hard rock, alternative rock background. Elijah's more of like a folk pop, would you say, kind of background. Silas is like very like singer songwriter slash like electric blues kind of thing. Greg and Tevin were both born and raised playing gospel music and funk and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's really interesting just knowing that when I bring a song in, or when Elijah brings a song in, or Silas brings one in, if we all start working on it together, it's most likely going to turn out absolutely nothing like we originally heard it.
Never know where it's going to go.
Exactly. But the fun part is it almost always turns out better than I originally envisioned it, you know? And so it's just fun to keep it fresh that way.
We're starting a lot to write songs together as a unit. One of the songs that will be on our upcoming album whenever that's released, called Ghost, is one that we actually, the five of us, got in a room. And I had two verses, and that's all I had. I had two verses in the beginning of a guitar part, and we wrote it there in the room as the five of us. And so we're starting to do that a lot with at least us three, the main songwriters, to sit down, bring in song ideas, or we have complete songs, and then we tweak them as a trio, and that's making things a whole lot more cohesive rather than three totally separate songwriters trying to bring their weird songs together and make them sound the same.
Because that's what a lot of our first EP is. It's five songs, and it's just a bunch of songs that we wrote ourselves, came into the band with, and they just kind of became what they are, kind of. And it's kind of us chasing our sound, becoming, you know, a band.
And it's all musically cohesive because we all wrote our own parts for each of the songs. There's still like the very distinctive Life Size sound to it, but it's more of a, you know, the music,
like, oh, this
that
is
shaped
Jake's
our
song,
background.
Or, oh, this is Silas's song, or oh, this must be Elijah's song. Kind of, you can kind of tell. Not that it's a bad thing.
But. Yeah, exactly. But as we push forward here, it's just becoming more and more of like a, we're more of a Lennon-McCartney thing, you know? Like there's more of like a...
I don't know if we're on
don't
that
make the
level.
Comparison. I'm not making that comparison. Oh my God. Oh my God. But anyway... But yeah, so, you know, we're becoming more of a team and developing more of a group identity than just, like, applying our sound to individual songs.
How How does the collaboration approach to songwriting affect your instrumentation? Because I assume that when you write a song for yourself, you put yourself where you want to be. How will you decide that now?
Not always. I mean, you can... I'll write a song on guitar and be like, nah, I don't like the guitar part. I'm going to go play piano on it now. Mm-hmm. You're like, nah, I don't really like piano anymore. I'm going to go play guitar on it now. But like, well, obviously when we write the song, it's got to stick, but... I don't know. I like to say we try to keep it a little even, try to, you know, bounce around, keep it interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of times if we write a song, like I write the songs that I'm going to sing, a lot of times that just ends up on acoustic guitar. And then usually to put a lead part to that, Silas just jumps on and throws that on electric guitar and Elijah ends up on piano. Or like I said, I'm getting into this whole piano thing. I wrote a song on piano the other day, and so hopefully I'll be able to play that eventually. But, you know, I'll be on piano for that. And then, you know, maybe we'll throw Elijah on electric just to shake it up a little bit and see what happens.
Yeah.
Greg and Ted, they play bass and drums, but they're so good at it.
They're rock solid. We don't want to move them. We're pretty okay at a lot of instruments. They're really good at their instruments.
It depends. We switch around a lot. For the most part, it's Silas and I switch. Which one's playing piano, which one's playing guitar. There have been songs that we've written before that we've actually switched on, but we've written parts that I end up being like, oh, I wrote this piano part, but Silas, can you play it? And it doesn't sound exactly the same, but it's similar. So it's a lot of mixing and matching, but it's still, that's one thing that I like a lot, that Silas and I play piano really similarly,
yeah.
And so a lot of our hooks sound the same, so it's not a big drastic jump when we switch piano. The song isn't going to sound different so much from a piano perspective. And although Silas is more proficient at acoustic guitar than I am, we kind of have a similar acoustic guitar style as well.
And I just hit it harder.
Yeah, exactly. So really, when we switch, it's not very drastic. It's not a big jump. Which is nice that it kind of just happened that
way. It's consistent for, once again, luck. Cause I can feel my life dissolving away like blue vitriol into water. I can feel my life dissolving away like blue vitriol into water. Every now and then I get a bit carried away, so please excuse the way I behave. I just wish there was something in this world that wouldn't fade, but these are the lies we create. And I can say the way I feel today, I've never felt that I'm so close to the edge before. Cause I can feel my life dissolving away like blue vitriol into water.
Tell me a little bit about your album that's coming out.
Well, yes. We recorded a live album at the Lee Street Theater in Salisbury. It was actually our EP release show when we released the Mockingbird Alarm Clock EP. We had a release show, and then we had the audio and a few videos recorded from that show, and now we're making that into an album. That's our next project, getting that all mixed and mastered and everything, getting that released. We also, like I said, we have some videos with it, so it'll be sort of like a multimedia release. We'll have the videos being released on specific intervals, like of a couple weeks or so.
Yeah, I think basically the plan, we're going to drop both the videos and the album and a website and refresh our YouTube channel all in one. We don't have a specific release date for that yet, but definitely stay posted. We'll say that'll probably be within the next 6 months to a year if we're being very generous and giving ourselves some time. But yeah, and it's going to be called Life Size Live at Lee Street. We're really excited about it, though.
Yes, we are.
We have some great audio that was done by 6 Foot Kitten out of Salisbury.
And video.
And video also done by 6 Foot Kitten. We got the album mastered at GAT3 Studios, where Silas is doing his internship. Mm-hmm. Right now we're looking for the graphic design components of it. But it should be fun. It's going to come out looking and sounding really good.
Yep, because we've always felt like sort of the one of the biggest parts about this band was just the live experience. You know, we just love to play live. We feel like that's one of our biggest joys in life. That's why we do this. So we wanted to sort of capture that and let it be spread to people who couldn't make it that night.
Yeah, it's raw. It's fun. It's live, and we're not ashamed of that.
Take a little peek into the life of Annalise. See a couple things you'll maybe see once or twice, but never three times. She laughs, not listening to my jokes, and I say, relax, it's late, let me take you home. And she agrees, cause the blend's a little more toxic than she's been used to lately. Her walls are covered in art, and her two arms are covered in scars, and her contact-covered eyes search the sky for her newest of paintings. Tonight I'll go to sleep alone and dream. And we now take a little peek into the life of Annalise. See a couple things you'll maybe see once or twice, but never three times. You say, I'll call your phone, but whenever you try, she's never home. You got nowhere to go, you're all alone, looking for your queen, but she's stuck playing hide and seek. Everybody said that everything happens for a reason. Maybe you'll speak then if Tiny Hawk could wait till the end of June. You'll see her soon, but the days keep growing longer than they should be. And they say you'll see she'll be around the corner of Fifth Street, but she's covered in mystery, mistreating the laws of coffee shops and bars and places I think are made to drive me crazy. But tonight I'll go to sleep alone and dream.
Life Size, live in Studio A, with Elijah Motika, Jake Martin, and Silas Boyle. On Saturday night, August 30th, from 10 to 1, they'll be joined by drummer Tevin Carr and bassist Greg Moore at Foothills Brewing Company in Winston-Salem. The event is free and open to the public, ages 21 and up. Life Size also has a new album, Live at Lee Street, and a website coming soon. For more, check out WFDD.org. And click on Live in Studio A.
Don't stop your breathing, cause you're wasting your time while you're looking for someone that only exists behind the sun. I swear she's not the only one, boy.
WFDD intern Michaela Nance. Time for a short break, and then we'll shift gears just a little with A Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War by Karen Abbott. Bethany Chapin chats it up with the two-time New York Times best-selling author next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Looking for your queen, but you're stuck playing hide and seek, yeah. Hide and seek, yeah. Hide and seek, yeah. My son, you're stuck playing hide and seek, hide and seek.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Lots of great music from Americana New Zealand style to blues by the banks of the New River coming up later on the show. And Dale Pollack takes us behind the scenes for an up-close and personal look at the movie reviewer's plight. But first, associate producer Bethany Chafin gets bookish with a little bookmarks preview.
New York Times bestselling author Karen Abbott has a new book out, and it has not one, not two, but four protagonists. Abbott's book is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. The women she writes of are varied, a socialite, a farm girl, abolitionist, and a widow. And while their methods of espionage differ, they are all united by the shared quality of fierce loyalty. Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy will be on sale September 2nd, and Karen Abbott will be at Bookmark's 10th Annual Festival of Books and Authors on September 6th. She'll be speaking in the Mount Castle Forum at the Milton Rhodes Center for the Arts from 12:45 to 1:45, with a book signing to follow at 1:45. Karen spoke to me from her home in New York City. How did you discover these four women? How did you decide that after two other books, also about fascinating women, that you were going to look at this era and specifically choose four very fascinating women who end up working for, you know, the side that they have chosen during the Civil War?
Yeah, you know, I had never given much thought to the Civil War. I lived in Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And in 2001, I moved to Atlanta and it was sort of a culture shock. I hadn't realized that the Civil War was still, you know, a current topic of discussion among people in the South. You know, it came up fairly often, and it never did in the North. You know, a couple people had Confederate flags on their lawns. I would see that fairly frequently. There were always jokes about the War of Northern Aggression. So it was just sort of seeped into everyday conversation in a way that it really doesn't up North. So that was intriguing to me. And one day I got stuck in traffic, in, you know, horrific Atlanta traffic, and behind a pickup truck that had a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me, I voted for Jeff Davis." And I just looked at that bumper sticker, you know, for the entire hour I was stuck in traffic and thought, you know, there must be something more here. What were the women doing? You know, you know what the men were doing. And it just sort of made me think, yeah, I want to know what the women were doing. And I came upon the character of Belle Boyd pretty early. She is a 17-year-old Confederate girl living in the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia, who kicks things off by shooting a Union soldier who invades her home and threatens to raise a Union flag. And Belle did not take too kindly to that and shoots him. And, you know, once I read that story, I was really intrigued and I wanted to see where it could go. And I wanted four women. I wanted to sort of weave a tapestry of both sides of the war, two for the North and two for the South, and see how their stories intertwined and sort of try to tell the story of the Civil War in a way it hadn't been told before.
Well, we've mentioned Belle just a bit, but I wonder if we could do a brief profile of the other three women. Maybe let's start with Emma Edmondson.
Sure. Emma was another fascinating character. She was actually living as a man before the war and decided to enlist in the Union Army. She was a Canadian who then became an itinerant Bible salesman and migrated over to the United States and was caught up in the rush to war and in the idea of fighting for the Union. And enlisted in the Army. And some of the most fascinating research came from, you know, how did she get away with it? There were about 400 women who disguised themselves as men on both sides for the Confederate and Union armies. And I just wanted to know how they got away with it. And one of the main reasons was because, you know, people were so used to seeing women's bodies pushed and pulled in exaggerated shapes by corsets and crinolines that they had no concept of what one would look like wearing pants, or let alone a whole army uniform. So just the very idea of a woman in pants was unfathomable. And so a lot of them just got away with it because no one could envision that. And I thought that was really interesting. And then there was Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who was this beautiful widow living in Washington, D.C. She was a Confederate sympathizer, you know, in the heart of the federal government. And she had quite a troubled past, a really tragic past. She had lost 5 children, her husband. With the inauguration of Lincoln, she had lost 20 years of connections in the White House. She had been a very powerful political woman. Her husband had worked for the government. And all of that was sort of taken away from her in one fell swoop with the election of Lincoln and with the war looming. And she, you know, any means necessary to sort of maintain her lifestyle and maintain her life as she knew it. And she, you know, started accomplishing these things by seducing Union and Confederate generals alike, and was very wily in the way she crafted a Confederate espionage ring right in the middle of the federal capital. And finally, there was her northern counterpart, Elizabeth Van Loo, who was northern sympathizing but lived in Richmond. So she was in the capital of the Confederacy and sort of the mirror opposite of Rose Greenhow. And she started a far-reaching espionage ring to benefit the Union Army, and was really ingenious in what she did. Her family formerly owned slaves, but she was an abolitionist and freed them all, and even managed to place one family former slave in the Confederate White House as a spy. You know, nobody knew that this woman was literate and highly intelligent and gifted with a photographic memory, and she became sort of the linchpin of Elizabeth's fantastic operation that worked for the Union Army.
The timelines and the way you structured your book, these women's stories weave together fairly seamlessly. And I'm wondering, did you research them together or independently? And how did you then decide, you know, how you were going to bring them together? Did they start to speak to one another in certain ways that you didn't expect?
You know,
that's
a really
maybe?
Good question, because, you know, there were other options, other women I could have chosen, but I was really deliberate about choosing those four. Number one, I thought they all were different enough and represented a sort of archetype that I wanted to explore. And number two, their stories all intersected to me in really interesting ways. Rose and Belle, of course, do meet in person. So there is a physical interaction there. But other than that, you know, the women's stories all bump into each other. They meet the same people. There's a cause and effect to their actions. You know, Rose is spying on the Union Army, you know, literally watching Emma Edmonds as she marches past. And Rose is spying directly affects Emma's experience in the Army. You know, I have one scene where Belle Boyd has a very vitriolic encounter with the Union General Beast Butler. And, you know, and in the next scene, he's recruiting Elizabeth to be a spy for the Union. So it's sort of everybody runs into everybody else, and there's a cause and effect. And at one point, I actually cut up a bunch of chapters in the women's scenes and sort of spread them around on my floor of my apartment. But it sort of put a puzzle piece together that way. And it was really helpful in terms of visualizing the connections. And actually, you know, some of them would just jump out at me in the way they couldn't have on a computer screen.
Right. That's actually a practice I've heard several writers say that they employ in order to help in that visualization, exactly like you did say. Well, you also mentioned that in some ways it was a puzzle. And I'm wondering, did you ever come across any pieces you knew were missing that, you know, maybe some mystery and you really had to dig? And how did you go about kind of filling that in?
You know, I was lucky that, oh God, this is like every historian's nightmare. You know, Mary Jane Bowser, the spy I mentioned that Elizabeth places in the Confederate White House, you know, there were reports that she had written a diary of her experience, which of course would be the mother load of fascinating information, but her family inadvertently threw it out in like the 1950s, not knowing what it was, which just makes me want to cry. But I was really lucky to connect with one of Elizabeth Van Loo's descendants, well, it's actually a descendant of her brother. And he filled in a lot of blanks, things that had never been published before about her operation, especially how her little brother had been involved, and also some of the things that Mary Bowser did do from the White House that had been passed down through the family. And, you know, fascinating information, like the brother had a hardware business and he would take his hardware invoices and he would write down, it would look like it was a normal invoice. And he was just sort of naming items of hardware and supplies he needed to pick up. But all of these numbers corresponded to troop numbers and to, you know, fortification numbers and weaponry. And so it was sort of they had their own code on these hardware invoices. And I thought that was a really fascinating little bit of information.
Yeah, so tell me more about some of the systems that were developed that were really just ingenious in terms of communicating. You know, women were keeping their most intimate letters and some of their possessions even close to their body, literally, in terms of sewing them into the actual garments. And you do mention that, but something I hadn't really heard about was the hidden messages within a hairstyle.
Yeah, I agree. I was really fascinated by that, too. I'll mention the first scene where that happens. It's actually a pretty pivotal scene. Rose Greenhow is preparing to deliver information to the Confederate Army on the eve of the First Battle of Bull Run, which is a crucial. It was the first major land battle of the war, and the Union had figured the war is going to be over in 90 days. All we have to do is crush them here. We move on to Richmond. The rebellion is over. Of course, the Confederacy had other ideas, and they knew that if they won this war would probably be a lot longer than anyone had anticipated, and they would actually have a fighting chance to last much longer than the Union predicted. So Rose O'Neill Greenhow gathers some information for the Confederate Army using her various lovers and sources and high up in the government. And she writes it in code. She has a code given to her. And she ties it up in this little silk pouch, a black silk pouch, and tucks this little silk pouch with the message in the bun of one of her couriers. Now, this courier is a 16-year-old girl, you know, who just looks lovely and innocent. And Rose tells her to dress like an innocent farm girl on her way from the market. So she puts on a calico dress and sort of a homespun look. And Rose does her hair up. And as soon as the girl gets past the Union lines, nobody thinks to question her, of course, she gets to General Beauregard's headquarters, lets down her hair, and retrieves this piece of information that goes on to be a really significant contribution to the Confederate victory at Bull Run. Yeah, and it's sort of the whole idea that women used their femininity, you know, the very things that worked against them in society, the idea that women are genteel and meek and don't wage war, you know, that women are the victims of war, they're not its perpetrators. You know, these women were able to sort of turn those constructs to their advantage. You know, and not only were they able to, you know, hide on their physical person, but they hid behind their personas as women. You know, anytime they were accused of something, I'm thinking about Elizabeth Ann Liu and detectives searching her home. And she would come back at them and say, well, how dare you search my home? I am a defenseless woman. This conduct is beneath an officer and a gentleman. And how dare you do this to a poor defenseless woman who is the victim of war here. But of course, Elizabeth is the one waging war. So I thought that was a really brilliant strategy.
Let me ask a little bit about your background and your interest in history. You have done, you're a contributor to Smithsonian Magazine. They have a history blog. And, you know, how did you begin knowing that, you know, writing about history was something that you wanted to do? And also, I guess this is a two-part question. When you come across a woman, or maybe in the future it'll be a male figure, at what point do you know, I have to write about this person?
That's a good question. You know, I had always enjoyed history, but I never thought to write about it. I started working as a journalist out of college, so not much history writing there. But when I moved to Atlanta is when I started thinking about history. And in particular, I was having a lot of conversations with my grandmother, who is now 96. She's still around. And she told me a story about her mother and her mother's sister, who emigrated from Slovenia in 1905. And the sister went to Chicago one weekend and had never been heard from again. So I started thinking about this, and I was always intrigued and haunted by this bit of family lore. And I began looking into what was going on in Chicago in 1905, and discovered that a lot of girls were disappearing. You know, my great-grandmother's sister wasn't the only one who disappeared. And then I came across a mention of the Everly Club, you know, that a lot of girls were disappearing into brothels. And one of these brothels that was mentioned was the Everly Club, which was this fantastic, lavish, world-famous brothel run by two sisters who claimed to be Southern Belles, and who were trying to elevate the profession and do something different. And, you know, whereas other brothels, you know, the madams whipped their girls and garnished their wages, the Everly sisters were trying to elevate the profession and feed their girls gourmet food and have them examined by an honest medical doctor and, you know, treat the girls well, like valued employees. And I thought this was fascinating, and the sort of whole progressive era culture war to shut them down. So that's when I started to get into history. It was that story. It wasn't even history itself. It was that story. I would have written it no matter what era it took place in. It just happened to be, you know, this 1905, the era of the grand brothel. So yeah, I guess it was specific to that time and place. But that's when the love of history began. I think it's really interesting that this is the first time, and I mentioned this briefly, but to elaborate on it, you know, this is the first time women were really waging war publicly. You know, I mean, there are accounts of women being involved in the Revolutionary War, but they were underground in a way that the women in the Civil War were really out there. Even with their, you know, they even like the Southern women sort of dropped their whole genteel lady act, and they would spit at Union officers who were occupying their towns and, you know, dump the contents of chamber pots in their heads. And it's sort of, there's whole a revolution about how women presented themselves during war, and the fact that Rose was an outspoken martyr. And the men, you know, on both sides just did not know how to deal with this. They didn't know what to do. It was the first time that women, you know, they weren't victims of war, they were its perpetrators. And I love the one quote from, I think, one Lincoln official who said, what do we do with these fashionable women spies? it just was a conundrum that they had never been presented with before. And I really thought that was interesting.
Karen Abbott is the author of Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. She is a featured contributor to Smithsonian Magazine's history blog, Past Imperfect, and also writes for Disunion, the New York Times series about the Civil War. Abbott will be at Bookmark's Festival of Books and Authors on September 6th, speaking in the Mount Castle Forum at the Milton Rhodes Center for the Arts at 12:45. For more information on Karen Abbott and her works, visit our website at wfdd.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And next up, we travel behind the scenes with film producer, writer, and educator Dale Pollack. Dale's produced 13 feature films. His movie Blaze, starring Paul Newman, was nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography. Dale's also the author of Skywalking, The Life and Films of George Lucas.
As a movie reviewer for a local TV station and a local radio station, I often feel I have the best job in the world. But that's until I go to the movies. Then I often think I have the worst job in the world, because who else would want to sit through some of the junk that Hollywood releases every weekend of the year? That's 52 times a year I have to sit through terrible movies every weekend. Now, why do I have to review these movies? I get to choose what I review, right? Well, radio and TV audiences want really only the big hit movies. They're not interested in the little art film. So I may enthuse about Boyhood, Richard Linklater's amazing 12-year odyssey of watching a kid grow up, but they want to hear about Into the Storm, the most stupid, the most ridiculous tornado-chasing movie I've seen in years. Now, this goes back to my roots. I started as a reviewer at a small-town paper in Santa Cruz, California, and then moved on to a daily paper, and then hit the big time when I was the film reviewer for Daily Variety in Los Angeles. Robert Osborne, now the host of Turner Classic Movies, who reviewed for The Hollywood Reporter, and I would gather at 9:30 in the morning on a studio lot and watch a movie, and we had to run a gauntlet of often the producer or the studio executive saying, "Well, what did you think?" I finally came up with my standard answer: "Only you could have made that film." On days when I wasn't at the studios, I was being sent up to Hollywood Boulevard, and this is in the mid-1970s, to review the triple features playing there, which usually consisted of Cannibal Holocaust, Holocaust of Cannibals, or Cannibals and Holocaust Victims together. These were not the high point of filmmaking. But of course, I was a trade reviewer, so my major job was to predict whether the film would do well or not at the box office. When I moved on to the Los Angeles Times, I bowed out of reviewing. Too much pressure, and I became a reporter covering the movie industry, which frankly to me was much more interesting. Now I teach at a film school, so I'm showing at least 3 films a week to my students and discussing them. And I do a blog now called Movie A Day, where I try to write about a movie every day of the week. That's not as hard as it sounds, because I see between 7 and 12 movies pretty much every week. The major problem I face is one of overload and monotony. How many more explosions can I witness? How many more computer-generated special effects will wash over me in an orgy of effects explosions? How many more bodies will be cut down? I lost count at 300 in the last Expendables 3. So don't feel too bad for me, but have a little sympathy for the poor guy who has to sit through stuff blowing up, FXing itself, and generally enriching Hollywood. Somebody has to do it. I guess it's me.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts Professor of Cinema Studies Dale Pollack. You can catch up with Dale daily with his Movie A Day blog, and you'll find links at WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and earlier this week, the Johnny Possum Band set sail on its 4th U.S. tour, and they had a lot of ground to cover just to get here. The band hails from New Zealand, but they've played their own unique brand of Americana at venues all across the Southeast, including Music City Roots in Nashville. This year, they'll be swinging through the Triad with outdoor concerts at Zick's Bar on the Upper Quad at Wake Forest University and the Muddy Creek Cafe in Bethania.
Town by the sea.
Since 2005, the Johnny Possum Band has transitioned from playing mostly bluegrass covers to their latest CD, Love and Truth, with 8 original songs. Why, we're sampling from that CD right now. With the hope of a better. Johnny Possum Band banjo player, guitarist, singer-songwriter Sean Whitaker spoke with me from his home studio in New Zealand. I mean, you make that shift from doing covers and recreating or reinterpreting the music of others into writing and recording and sharing your own songs. What's that transition period like? Can you think back to those early days of bringing your own music forward and what that was like?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think on a personal level for any artist, it's something I think most artists aspire to, and you begin to take those first steps of writing your own songs and then being unsure of what they're like or what they should be like and developing a confidence about your own songwriting abilities. And then for me, when we started out as songwriters, we felt a pressure to write songs in a certain way. So our first attempts at songwriting were very bluegrass-style songs. And then as we sort of realised that the real beauty in writing songs came from the collaborative effort of all the members of the band, we realised that we were defining our own style. Finally made it home tonight. It's a really great journey, and for me personally there's a lot of nerves involved in, you know, writing your own music because you're exposing yourself, particularly with the folk styles or the country styles. The lyrics are usually based on some element or one small sentence from your own life. We got 8 original tracks on the latest CD, and I can actually hear the different songwriters, their melodic style, the choice of lyrics, the phrasing, and all of that too. So that's still very evident with that sort of journey of self-discovery.
There's a certain letting go part of that, though, that can be uncomfortable for some. How do you all manage those waters? Is it difficult?
It can be sometimes. For a couple of my songs, you know, I've been very precious about them. I've introduced them to the band, and the band has suggested, well, let's do this with it. Now, there's one particular song I can think of that they turned into a straight bluegrass number a couple of years ago. And for me, I was like, okay, well, that's what happens to it when it hits the band environment. But the version I released myself earlier this year was a very slow, melancholy version, a completely different version. Same lyrics, same melody. So I think that's what you do working in a band that's a collaborative form of band, and that's what we are. We all respect each other and what we bring to the band. We all have different strengths, and in the songwriting process, that comes through. My love, I'm going under. We've had a lineup change. The fiddle's gone and the mandolin's gone, so we've definitely lost that traditional bluegrass lineup. So this time we're down to a 4-piece instead of the usual 5-piece. We've brought in Rebecca Dollery, and she's got just an amazing voice, and what her and Brizzy are doing as lead vocalists is quite stunning. We're really happy with the sound of the band. Worn out hands, what
do they bleed? Beautiful harmonizations and a real warmth to the sound that it just popped out as very contemporary and yet very comfortable. Like I know this sound. It's a beautiful mix.
Yeah, well, we're really happy with it. So the lead track, Love and Truth, is one that Brizzy wrote, and he takes lead vocals, and you can hear Rebecca on there in harmony. But most of the tracks, she's actually taking lead vocals, and she's got an absolutely stunning voice, and we're really pleased with this wonderful interplay between the male and female. And yeah, so things like Fleetwood Mac come to mind, and perhaps more contemporary. There are tracks that sound very much like the Civil Wars. Personally, I'm really happy with the new sound, and I think the whole band is as well.
Dig Between the Lines, Complicated Times, Find My Way Back Home. Who wrote the lyrics for this one?
That's Brizzy's number. He does great work on the lyrics and great work on the melody. So I don't know the story behind that. He's a bit of a closed book when it comes to revealing the actual inspiration for his music. But it's very catchy, and that's why we chose to release that one as the first single. And the bonus is, after years of nagging the band, they finally let me play guitar. So I'm really happy. So I get to bring a resonator guitar with me this time, and I've got double duties, banjo and resonator guitar, so I'm really happy.
For a better day, last battle, last of my money, now I'm on my knees, looking for love and truth.
The Johnny Possum Band, banjo player, guitarist, singer-songwriter Sean Whitaker. Their new CD is Love and Truth, and you can hear selections live on Saturday night, August 30th, at Zick's Bar on the Upper Quad on the campus of Wake Forest University, where the Johnny Possum Band will be live in concert. The following afternoon, they'll be at Muddy Creek Cafe in Bethania, and two more North Carolina stops are scheduled during the month of September. You'll find links to the Johnny Possum Band's complete tour schedule at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. So, what do you say we take another short little intermission? No? Does the mere thought of Triad Arts Weekend going away for just 60 seconds give you the blues? Well, fear not, because when we return, I'll have more outstanding blues than you can shake a stick at right here in the studio with me. The King Bees have been a stingin' and a swingin' for decades, and they've assembled an incredible lineup for this year's New River Blues Festival, and it's coming up next when Triad Arts Weekend continues, so stick around. This is Triad Arts Weekend. Dancing in a mountain meadow by an ancient river with the sounds of live world-class blues wafting all around you. It may sound just too good to be true. In fact, I was getting a little misty-eyed just going there with you for a second. But believe you me, it is not too good to believe. Why, it's the 12th annual New River Blues Festival, and it's coming up this weekend in beautiful Grassy Creek, North Carolina, on the shores of the New River. Gates open at noon, the music starts at 1, and it'll be performed this year by another stellar lineup. Johnny Neal, Charlie Sayles and Tony Fazio, Pat Mother Blues Cohen, Boo Hanks, and the New River Blues Festival directors Penny Queen Bee Zamagni and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville. Together, they are the King Bees, and they've been stinging and swinging together for more than 25 years. In fact, we're sampling from their latest album right now.
To the man, if you please your woman, she will never tell her friends. She's never gonna.
In general, the artists that you guys have rubbed elbows with, the list goes on and on, but you're presenting them to many of us for the first time. That's kind of part of your all's mission.
That is our mission, that in rural Appalachia, blues is very, really unheard of, and so we bring these artists who with whom we have mentored and have listened to for many, many years, decades, in fact. We bring them up to Ashe County, and we're introducing our artists also to a cultural milieu that they've not been exposed to, and beautiful area as well. And the folks who live there are getting to see real deal Southern blues greats, luminaries, and lifeblood of the blues. So it's a great cross-pollination.
And this is not, you all are no fly-by-night organization, 12 years, the 12th annual New River Blues Festival, and we've seen a lot of changes along the way, some good, not so good. But tell me about the evolution of New River Blues.
Well, we started small in our little hometown of Todd, which is, in fact, on the New River. And as the festival grew, we've now moved it to Grassy Creek. We have a larger space on the river to Riverhouse Inn. Through the years, we've brought some of the most iconic Southern blues greats. The unfortunate part is these folks are passing. And so it's even more important that we expose them, we promote them, we support them to folks who really need to hear and want to hear them, because unfortunately over the last few years we've lost about 7 artists that we have presented at our festival.
And it's the only opportunity for people in our region to see these artists, because a lot of these artists either that we've presented in the past have worked, you know, pretty much exclusively, you know, the Southern African-American Chitlin' Circuit, playing for all black audiences, and we've been fortunate enough to accompany them as the band on a lot of these shows, working in these major festivals with Clarence Carter and Theotis Ely and people like that. And this is a chance for people where we live to see them. And some of the artists that we are bringing this year are really elusive. For instance, Charlie Sayles is not an artist, even though he's performed at the Smithsonian, worked with Pete Seeger. He's not someone that you just go out and see. He doesn't make a lot of festival appearances, so we're extremely happy and proud to be bringing him to New River Blues Festival this year. Fabulous harmonica player.
Charlie Sayles, each of these artists, many of them, have been through so much, and their lives are just as fascinating many times as the music. What do we know about Charlie?
We first met him probably 25 years ago at a festival when we were working with Chicago Bob Nelson, who is another great harmonica player who we've had at the festival and is one of our teachers. And we were really impressed with Charlie's originality. He was a unique artist and have always wanted to do something with him. So we've just had the opportunity. And talk about a really fascinating life. He lives in D.C., but...
He was a foster child. He was an orphan. Went through many foster homes, went to Vietnam, lost an eye, was homeless for quite a long time, but always had his music. And so the Smithsonian kind of discovered him and brought him forward and hooked him up with Pete Seeger. And so he's an elusive genius. He chooses his venues very carefully. Not many festivals are on his itinerary, so we're very proud that he agreed to come.
You know, there are so many phenomenal blues artists around the world. We talk about many who never made it or never discovered or never chose to be so. What sets these great artists apart?
I think it's originality. I mean, it's sort of like any really good musician can copy someone else's. But if you have your own voice, your own sound, your own persona in the music, that's what sets you apart. And that's what all of our teachers along the way have said. You know, it's like, Rob, don't try and sound like B.B. King. Try and sound like Hound Dog. And, you know, that takes a while. It's not something that you develop overnight. You develop it over decades of working with different artists and soaking in their influence on what they're doing or not doing on their instrument.
Well, one of those artists is certainly Boo Hanks. He's been doing it for decades.
Boo is one of the last remaining artists who is playing in the Blind Boy Fuller tradition. And he has been, I guess you would say, undiscovered, but he's played music all his life. His life was spent by day in the tobacco fields and by night playing in the juke joints and playing music for his own pleasure. And only in the past few years has he really been discovered, and he really is a treasure.
Shot them, but no policeman's coat, just to ride on that railroad bill. Oh, they gon' ride.
You all are lifting up not just the male blues artists in the world, but some of the great female artists as well. And Pat Mother Blues Cohen, tell us about Mother Blues.
Mother Blues was on the New Orleans blues scene for many decades. She was playing six nights a week. She was the divine blues mama of New Orleans. Then Katrina hit, and we know all the devastation to the culture and the music that was affected on New Orleans during that time. So she moved to North Carolina, and things really opened up for her. She's become international. She is able to embody the spirit of, say, like Bessie Smith, that classic blues, as well as Big Mama Thornton. So she covers a lot of bases. She's extremely exuberant, lots of showy kind of attitude.
The entertainment angle is not missing.
Great.
You can have my husband, but please don't mess with my man.
Please don't mess with my man.
You can have my husband, please don't mess with my man.
Please don't mess with my man.
Telling all you ladies, 'cause I want.
What's the best part of this festival for you all? It's a lot of work. It's a labor of love. But when you look at it, what's the best part of the fest?
At the end of the day, when you know that you and the artists that you're working with have left it all on stage, you've put everything out, you've played the best blues that you can, and you've entertained to the best of your ability, when it's all over and done with, if you can look back and say that you've done that, it's quite a release.
And for me, that, of course, and also to watch the crowd and to see the dancing, and to see the joy and the celebration, and to understand that music is the language that we're all speaking. And I will say there are people of many different political points of view, of many different socioeconomic levels and races, but that day everyone is is not to be cliche, but everyone is one. Everyone is together. And the joy that you see on people's faces, the uninhibited kind of celebration of music and of the mountains and of the natural beauty that we find ourselves in.
Penny, Queen Bees of Magny, and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville, the King Bees. Together, they direct and organize the New River Blues Festival, bringing the luminaries and lifeblood of blues to the heart of rural Appalachia. New River Blues 2014 is this Sunday, August 31st, at the River House Inn in beautiful Grassy Creek, North Carolina, on the shores of the New River. Gates open at noon with live music from 1 to 6, performed by Johnny Neal, Charlie Sayles and Tony Fazio, Pat Mother Blues Cohen, Boo Hanks, and the King Bees. You'll find links to the complete performance lineup at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. It'll be 5 full hours of hot blues in the cool mountains with food provided by Farm to Flame Food Truck. Advance tickets are $17 and $20 at the door.
My husband, please don't mess with my man. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And we'd like to wish our summer intern, Michaela Nance, all the very best as she returns to college this fall. Thanks for your great work, Michaela. Excellent attitude and thoughtful questions. You'll be missed. And to our listeners, you needn't miss out on any of our shows. They're archived on our website alongside the podcasts at WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, if you've got a question, comment, or suggestion, we really would love to hear from you. Send your emails to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.